Hold there, Bruce. Yep.
There we go. Okay. Well, good morning, everyone, on this kind of dreary, wet, and soon-to-be icy day in February. This is the February meeting of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. I am Brendan Sharkey, the chair of the ACIR, and I'm joined by our vice chair, Lyle Ray, who's waving his hand, and other notables who are members, and welcome to those of you who are not members but are interested in participating. As we do at all these meetings, we just want to remind folks of the protocols here that to please keep your mics on mute unless you're speaking, and if you wish to be recognized, if you could either wave to the camera or use the raise hand function at the bottom of your screen to be recognized. All right. With that, let's see. I was just saying before we started recording that we know we have a couple of folks who won't be with us, and we also have a couple of vacancies. So reaching our quorum will be a little bit of a challenge. So I'm going to rely on Bruce to give me a thumbs up when we know we do have a quorum so we can start taking up the voting items on our agenda promptly. We also had later on in the agenda have a presentation from Fran Rabinowitz, the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Superintendents of Schools, or public school superintendents, I believe is the actual title. So we kind of want to move the agenda around a little bit to make sure that we've got a quorum to do voting on items that require voting, and then otherwise allow folks to enter and leave as they need to. So maybe the first thing, we'll skip over item two, which is the approval of the draft minutes, because I think we're still one short or two short of a quorum. But maybe, Bruce, if you don't mind, could you just kind of update everyone a little bit on the status of some new members of ACIR that will be joining and are being approved by the governor and others before they join us? Where do we stand right now?
Okay, sure. There is a new member as of this week. However, he doesn't really add to the total of new members. Oh, I should turn my video on and not do this in darkness. This week, Betsy Guerra of COSS, or I should say COSS in general, designated Carl Kilduff, who is the town manager of Clinton, to be COSS designee. So basically the equivalent of what Ron Thomas does on behalf of CCM, being their designee. COSS is looking for a person to represent a town of less than 10,000 to replace Bob Valentine, who left office last fall. And CCM has a nomination that, as far as I know, is currently being processed by the governor's office, and we should hear about that shortly. And if Ron knows that the person has already been appointed, don't say anything now because the person isn't here and we don't want to make the quorum even more difficult.
It's not official yet. Okay.
Yeah, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's kind of what we know to be the case, that they're still considering the nomination. And so hopefully next month that person will be in attendance.
Great. Thanks, Ron. I think, Bruce, aren't there a couple of other vacancies that have yet to be filled or vetted through the governor's office? Or does that cover it?
I think that covers it.
Okay, great. Okay, good. Well, I know we had a couple of folks who did check in with us to let us know that they weren't going to make it today. So I'll rely on you, Bruce, again to kind of do the count for us so we can make sure that we're taking up our items when we have the quorum available. Let's see. So let's maybe in terms of skipping around a little bit on the agenda around the topics that require votes. I'm actually going to jump way ahead, I think, and move to item 7 on our agenda, which is the local government of the future initiative. I wanted to do that because first on that agenda, we do have the draft of the Home Rule and Local Control Report that John has really put together. I think we're ready, right, to offer that up to the legislature, particularly the Planning and Development Committee, for their consumption. What else do we need to do on that, John, in order to have that submittable?
Well, you have that that draft that, as I've said in the past, I'm not entirely comfortable with, but I think it does at least provide a basis for and most certainly the legal basis for our definition of home rule. I also think it raises a number of questions that warrant a good amount of additional study. So I think sort of if I can suggest maybe a two-part approach would be to forward that to them so that it starts, at least we have a starting document that provides guidance for what is home rule and perhaps opens the discussion on local control. But I think it probably warrants this group to do some a deeper dive on that state local relationship and home rule and local control and how and that might be changed, especially as relates to local government of the future. Some of these questions were raised in 1987 when ACIR did their initial study on home rule. As far as I can tell, none of them were addressed, especially with regards to Title VII. So it may be one where we say, here's our report, and perhaps it may warrant P&D putting forth a directive to us to do a further dive on just what the relation, how the relationship might be improved or amended, a remodification of Title VII. I'm kind of rambling around a little bit there, but I think we've scratched the surface, but we've got a lot more to do. I think okay. In terms of what is home rule, that's crystal clear as far as I'm concerned. You know, I don't think it is in the eyes of many lawmakers. But I think as far as the law goes, that's pretty clear.
So, as I recall, we've talked obviously between the last meeting and today. But as I remember, we do have a report that is referencing the legal parameters of this. That's an adaptation of Steve Mednick's work that he had done previously with some other small additions. And your recommendation is that we get that to the Planning and Development Committee for now, perhaps with a suggestion that they may want us to look deeper into the other issues you've raised.
Yeah, because I believe they need the clarity on what is home rule and some of our insights on local control, but There are large issues there with that state local relationship and as it's now articulated or the confusion that Title VII in particular can cause.
Yeah. Okay.
And perhaps we can add some clarity to that.
So I think that is also a votable item, right? By the board, by the group, to send that initial that you've created off of Steve Mednick's plan. And are folks comfortable? I'll get to you in a sec, Jim. Are we comfortable with what that contains and whether we're good with, as to whether we can present that? Is the group comfortable with that? Bruce, I'm acknowledging you first for procedural reasons.
I just wanted to say that I'm looking at the agenda and I see I did not include a link to that report in this agenda. It was circulated previously, but I don't know if members are going to know exactly what they're being asked to vote on.
Okay, yeah.
Can we put the link up while we're talking?
I'll see if I
can. Yeah, could you put it in the chat, Bruce?
I'll see what I can do. I'm working from home and my connection to the state network isn't working today, so I'll see what I can do.
Okay, that'd be great. And then if folks can kind of take a look at that, as Bruce said, it has been disseminated and it's a fairly precise document that doesn't go beyond the initial purpose of just defining the legal parameters of what home rule is and is not. But maybe if Bruce can get that posted, and in the meantime, we'll come back to that for a voting item. Jim, in the meantime, though, you had your hand raised.
Yes, thank you. Just a question. Do I recall correctly that the last time we talked about this, Senator Cassano or someone was going to be getting a group together? I remember mentioning Craig Miner, and then there were some others mentioned who were going to get together and have a discussion about this, and maybe that would shed a little light on the next step.
Yeah, that's a great point. You're right. He did mention that, and that maybe by our submitting this over to P&D now, that'll help jog that conversation. To your point, so yeah. Thanks for remembering that. That's true. He did suggest that. I think it's really important that we get something out and to the committee on this topic before session begins. I don't think we should wait till the March meeting to formally vote. I think it's critically important that we get it out to them before the session begins, so they have something to work with, and then we can always do the follow-up later. John, you?
Yeah, I think in terms of what the senator was proposing is a good thing in terms of what I was suggesting for the study, because part of that discussion was, and the senator I see is on now, is to get perspectives from local officials, which is a good thing to get. And in terms of what I'm suggesting in terms of the study, because we see that it varies all over the place. But as Steve Mednick pointed out in his work and the report that I've drafted, the question of what is home rule is quite clear. Interpretations as the local, when we get into local control and even what some people actually believe home rule is, goes all over the board. That I see is more proper in that study. But in terms of getting something to the committee that outlines more factually what it is as a starting point, I think our paper does that.
Right.
Larger discussion that the senator suggested, I think, would be what I would envision with sort of this formal study, because in the several weeks since our last meeting, we just simply aren't able to do justice to what he was suggesting.
Right. Okay.
There's an awful lot there to do, and it was a really good suggestion, but
okay.
We need to be organized to do that.
Right. So, Senator, I just wanted to fill you in on this. Welcome. We were skipping around on our agenda because we have some quorum requirements that we're going to need. So voting items, we're going to wait until we have a full quorum. But one of the items that we're taking up is that study that John has really been championing on what is home rule. And also then the discussion of what is the relationship between state and local that we need to take into account. And I think what the group has resolved to do and vote on today when we have a quorum is to send to the Planning and Development Committee the initial report, which is really just the legal outline of what is home rule, what is not home rule, to help create that definition and to take up the suggestion you had made, Senator, at our last meeting. We are also recognizing that we need to have that deeper conversation. And you had suggested maybe pulling together a bipartisan discussion among legislators in a non-contentious kind of a way to sort of talk about and talk through what the relationship is and should be between state and local, that perhaps the ACIR can be tasked with diving deeper on between now and the 2023 legislative session. So I'm just catching you up on that. And I don't know if you had anything to add on that. You're muted, Senator.
I'm fine with that. One thing that I would want is that I don't want to do this on the phone. I want to have an in-person conversation with particularly my minority leaders from the House and Senate. We get along well. We talk well. I think it would be good to approach them in person to have this discussion because the reality is they represent a lot of the smaller towns, and it's the smaller towns that tend to be more our, and so they've got to be on board. And so I'd be glad to do that.
Great. Okay, thank you. Bruce, with Senator's addition, are we now at quorum?
No, you're still too short.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm busy hunting down a way to get the report online
I can provide a
link.
Multitasking, yeah. But okay, that's fine. We'll come back to it. Don't worry. Okay. And let's just see. Okay, great. So we'll save that for, I'm just making a note to myself that we'll need to come back to that. The other item under the LGF initiative, item number 7 on our agenda is, now that we've done a lot of substantive work on the home rule issue and also on the remote meeting study, which we're also going to vote on later in the meeting, we had reserved for ourselves the discussion of what should the LGF initiative be taking on as we go forward this year. I wanted to just point out to the group that there have been a number of, if you haven't been watching already, obviously, there's been a number of very robust proposals that are coming from both sides of the aisle in terms of proper of tax relief generally. And just 2 days ago, the governor issued his package of tax relief proposals, which included a number of property tax initiatives in particular. Just a little aside, I had spoken to some of the key folks who were involved in this, including committee leadership and the governor and others from the administration, about one of my own pet issues, which is the car tax and the, I think I use the word perniciousness of the car tax in terms of its unfairness and its regressive reality. And I said it on during an appearance on Capitol Report a few weeks ago, where I was asked what I would do if I could wave a magic wand. But I just never really felt that from the folks in the legislature and in the administration that was necessarily something they were interested in taking on this year. Martin, maybe you can fill in on this too, but I was really pleased to see that as part of the governor's package, a car tax reduction or mitigation plan that's very similar to what we did in what we tried to do in 2015 is now part of the governor's proposals. So I just wanted to bring that to folks' attention. I don't know where folks may what's CCM's position and cost position on that are, but I for me, that was a very positive thing. The last thing I'll say about that is the reason it didn't work fully in 2015 is that we didn't have any money. We didn't have any money to be able to compensate higher mill rate towns for their lost revenue. And we had some sort of convoluted methodologies and formulas on how to do that, but it left it falling short for these last 5 or 6 years. And so thankfully, the state's in a position where it does have some resources that it can put towards this. And I'm glad to see that this is one of the areas that was out there. So, Martin, I don't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Sure, happy to. Thanks, and good morning, everybody. So as people probably aware, when this was originally, instituted, they were looking at a 35 cap, I believe, was the original one, which they never even instituted at that point, and then they were looking at other numbers. It kind of wound up increasing over the years, and now it's at 45, which only 8 municipalities actually receive funds in that because it's over 45. Governor's proposal is obviously to reduce it to 29, which will provide about 103 municipalities with reimbursements back to assist them. 20 of the 25 distressed municipalities would actually be affected as well for that, being able to, lower that, runs, all of that type of stuff, of town by town runs of the numbers and all that will be out with the budget documents and everything that way. I think it's a step to show, it's, the governor's office looked at this is a direct thing that a taxpayer could look at because they see that tax bill. A property tax bill, they don't necessarily see if it's paid through another company, mortgage and such. So they wouldn't see the direct that way, which is why they looked at this. It's a formula that's already in state statutes for this. So it's just reducing the mill rate cap at this point. As we know, in the past, there's been discussions of a statewide mill rate on it. I believe this is, it's a step into, looking at all the motor vehicle. Is it a catch-all for everything? No, but it's a step in the right direction. And that's the way the governor's looking at this, to move forward as we still consider other options regarding the motor vehicle, property tax. One other quick thing is, Brandon, as you mentioned about, what other initiatives you think that this, should be coming up with and everything. Some of it may be waiting, for this session to see, what comes out of it and what things, initiatives they might be, rather than, us trying to figure out, or anticipating what may happen on it. So it may be kind of, let's wrap up the things that are being worked on here, finalizing those things and, be ready to, start the ground running, at the end of session with whatever initiatives might come up, or, throughout session, if something comes up that they need assistance with, and maybe look at taking it that way rather than us trying to assume what's going to be happening.
Yeah, that's a great point, Martin. I think that makes a lot of sense. It certainly is in our wheelhouse of things that we would be doing, and I've already offered to both the governor and to Commissioner Boughton, the ACIR, as a resource on developing the longer term policy post 22 session. So if folks are amenable to that, I'd like to have that as a placeholder for future discussion after session is over. I think, Martin, you make a great point that we should see what sifts out and what issues get resolved or don't get resolved by the end of session so that we can weigh in on that. And I want to recognize the three folks that have their hands up, but I just want to ask folks who are in the meeting now to please stay in the meeting. I think now with Francis joining on, I think we actually do have a quorum, and there are voting items that we do need to get out today. So please don't leave until we can get to, and we'll get to the voting items as quickly as we can. So with that in mind, Francis, I think you had your hand up first, and then we'll go to John.
Thank you, Brendan. I agree with Martin. It is a step in the right direction. When you look at the car tax and its unfairness across municipalities. But I think this is also someplace where ACIR could weigh in insofar as there are some local state relationships and state federal relationships at play here. One of them is that the car tax, even with the SALT cap, is federally deductible. Motor vehicle registration is not deductible. So every, you know, that's a consideration there. And, you know, the governor could, for instance, say, well, we're going to cap the car tax at maybe a slightly higher rate, but we're going to eliminate the cost of motor vehicle registration. And that would bring in marginally more money to Connecticut. And if we look at the local state relationship in terms of equity, we know that lapsed registrations can really add up, compound, create problems, especially for low income people very quickly. People forget about the registration. They get pulled over without an active registration. More fines accrue. And it's really quite a punitive system that a lower motor vehicle tax rate does help with the household burden for the taxes, but it doesn't maximize federal transfers. And it doesn't get people out of the pipeline or the spiral of fees adding up and losing their ability to get to work. If we look at how the DMV is currently structured with the property tax, the fact that to drive a car in Connecticut, you have to go to the DMV and also to your local tax collector. You have two points of contact with government, even though those two already talk to each other and you can't register a car for which property tax is not paid. That's a redundant point of contact. It's creating additional work that we really, you know, why is it that you have to register your car in addition to paying taxes? Why can't you do it all in one transaction? So I think there's some bigger picture items there where we could simplify government for the end user. We could eliminate people getting hit with fees for unregistered cars, and we can increase federal transfers even more if we look at it strategically and start thinking about business process reengineering and not just adjusting rates.
Great. Yeah, I agree. That's a great point. Thanks, Francis. John?
Thank you. I just wanted to make a couple of comments on the governor's proposals, which I think are terrific and a great step in the right direction. In particular, I just want to talk about the property tax credits, because this is something I've been working with 1,000 Friends of Connecticut for the last many, actually last many years, but the last many months in particular, on updating a property tax document, which I believe Bruce circulated. And one of the key additions I think that's needed to his proposals is that these property tax credits be refundable. If they're not refundable, then low-income households just won't get the assistance they need. They're going to be really excluded from that. So that's a critical addition. And if folks can take a chance to look at that, and maybe in the future, if we could even get a chance to present on that, you know, there was a quite a solid group of people to put that together, notably Bill Seabus, who most of you are familiar with, who's was the secretary at OPM and a legislator. I think these are what he's proposed here. All of them are great elements of property tax relief and probably components of property tax reform long term. And I think this group really can be an asset to the state long term, well beyond this session, in working on property tax structural reform, which, as Lyle likes to emphasize, that's the critical element, is the structural reform. Right. Relief is great, but those overall reforms long term is really what we need to do to turn us into the regressive tax that it is, into one that's more progressive and balanced, which is so out of balance now.
Great, yeah.
That it just hurts people.
Agreed. Yeah, thanks, John. Ron?
Yeah, I'll be quick. I know we want to get to voting items. You asked about CCM. Of course, we all agree that the property tax on motor vehicles is highly problematic. CCM is going to be in discussion with this membership on next week, and we'll be able to give you a fuller response to the governor's proposal. But we appreciate the fact that, as you said before, there's been some significant changes since the last time there was a major proposal. So,
yeah.
Keep you updated.
And I know you guys are already, you know, you guys have been working long and hard on this too. It's not like there's a desert out there of folks looking at tax issues generally, but property tax issues in particular. So, you know, we'll be obviously be working with you guys as we go forward. And if there are, if you can envision niches that the ACIR can fill in the discussion, maybe we can start formulating that. So by the time we get to May and beyond, we have our marching orders. So thanks. Okay, so that's good. I think that provides us some direction on that. And before we leave this item 7 on our agenda, I don't want to skip over the discussion that Jim had raised and has raised a couple of times at our meetings about the emergency management system as an LGF initiative. And I'm kind of, Jim, I'm wanting perhaps to give our folks a little bit of direction on how we might launch that or get that started, and who should formulate a kind of a smaller group to perhaps start framing the conversation so that the ACIR can think about it and comment on it.
I guess I would say, in terms of a smaller, the first thing I think is that we need to have an explanation of what is involved with this, what makes this a problem, why is it an issue for local government and for the state and for the governor, for that matter. So I think we need to have that discussion. That would be the first thing. And then once we have that discussion, decide, do we want to take a deeper dive into that and try to suggest a solution to the problem? So that's number one. Number two, I suspect that there are members of the commission currently who have an awareness of this problem, and so we could have a subcommittee of the commission. If we need to, we could bring in some folks from local government and from the state. You know, I don't know if how up to speed Martin is with knowledge about this problem, but I'm sure we could get a group together as a subcommittee and discuss this.
Well, Jim, could I make a suggestion?
Sure.
I mean, we have our standing subcommittee meeting, later in the month. And I think this month, we're recognizing that maybe some of the items that we might otherwise be taking up in the LGF context, we either may be on hold until the session's over, or maybe on hold for some other legislative direction. I'm thinking in particular about the home rule discussion. I wonder if we can dedicate our meeting, our subcommittee meeting this month, to that topic. And if you're in agreement with that, if you could work with Bruce and me and others about kind of setting up that meeting to bring in folks who can have that conversation to kind of lay the foundation for what the issue is, what what direction ACIR can take. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay. All right. Well,
I'd be interested to know, Martin, do you, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have a sense of what it is that we're talking about in terms of the problem?
I can't really comment on it at this time, so.
Okay. Yeah. I think one of the important issues that we have to be sure of, so to speak, is that we don't want to be adversarial to the governor. I mean, at least I don't. I want this to be a frank discussion of, you know, what the system is and how it should work, and hope that we have a, you know, a cooperative view about this. I don't think we'll be getting anywhere if we if it's adversarial. It really involves the governor and the state agencies as well as municipalities.
Oh, yeah. Now, thanks for that, Jim. Martin, if I could, are there, is it your sense or do you sense that the administration is already on top of this to the point where if ACIR is involving, that may be redundant? Or do you think there's something we can add to the conversation that would be helpful?
So I think, you know, no, it's, you know, there's always time to add stuff to it. I mean, it's a proposal that's going in, as we know, like, you know, motor vehicles, there's probably going to be other proposals out there in session, and there's going to be discussion on it. I mean, this is, you know, the governor's proposal is part of the budget to you know, provide property tax relief, you know, in the form of, you know, the motor vehicle, you know, with some of the surplus funds that we have, you know, because we do have them, let's, you know, it's a way to give it back to the residents, you know, of the state to be able to reduce their property taxes. As we know, every year there's multiple legislation pieces that come out, you know, regarding motor vehicle taxes to eliminate, to put a statewide cap, everything else. So all of that.
Yeah,
has
I'm
to...
sorry, Martin, but,
oh,
but
I'm sorry.
particularly on the EMS question that Jim was raising.
Oh, yeah. And the EMS, been... yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's the same type of thing, you know, is that, you know, there's definitely, you know, avenues to be able to assist in everything, you know, okay. On that. I'm not as familiar with the whole EMS side of it.
Okay, great.
You know, so, but, and, you know, and what any proposals may be coming out of there. But I think, you know, as you've mentioned, Brendan, is, you know, that we offer up ACIR as a tool to be able to, and a resource, you know, to help explore this, or if they're looking for, you know, a quick, you know, survey or, you know, study or something else, you know, on it, that, you know, there can be some, you know, advantageous, you know, help that we could give them.
Good. Okay, that's great. As long as we're not in conflict with anything that's going on in the administration. Okay, so Jim, we'll set that up. And I don't want to squelch conversation. I'm just mindful of the time and the fact that we have this presentation later in the agenda. So if we could, we can let's move on if everybody's okay, unless someone's got, you know, something really pressing that they've got to mention. I'm just mindful of the clock on this. Bruce, is there?
Yeah, let me turn my video on again.
Sure.
There still is not a quorum. I had been hoping that while this part of the discussion had been continuing, that maybe two more people would join, but you're too short. I suspect it's because of, you know, the potential ice storm and having some municipal members that may be more focused on that. But you're still too short, according to my count.
I thought with Francis coming on and Senator Cassano, and, you know, we were two before and those two came on and we were at our numbers.
It actually had been three. Francis was there early. I had included him early.
Okay.
And unfortunately, you're still too short.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, then we'll really pack together. Hopefully, if there's someone else who's joining us, we can. Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, Bruce, can you could you email me some names of some people and some phone numbers or emails or whatever, and I can try to reach them, get a couple of people on.
Yeah, let me see what I can do.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll make a couple of phone calls too.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I guess we could do a poll. You know, a virtual poll if necessary, but you know, but I particularly with regard to the two reports that were submitted to the legislature, I think it would be helpful for the full body to formally vote on it at its meeting if we can possibly do that. So, John, did you have
one quick suggestion since we did send the hybrid meeting to the committee, the two committees as an interim, so that we could get it to them. Can we do that the same thing with the home rule, so that if we don't end up getting a vote today?
Why don't we cross that bridge if we have to?
And the other quick question, and I know, you know, I don't want to belabor time. I really don't know what the issue is with the EMS to even know if I would like to volunteer. I know I, as a COG, have been immersed in this issue, and I know that the system that was in place really didn't work in the terms of COVID. And we've had to kind of recreate it in many ways and work around it. But if that's the issue, then that's worthy of talking about going forward. But I'm not sure what the issue is to even volunteer.
That's the issue, John. The issue is the disconnect between the state agencies, the Division of Emergency Management plan that we all would have assumed would have been trained to believe is the correct way of responding to an event.
Okay.
Bottom line is it didn't work.
Right. Okay. So we'll reserve that for our subcommittee meeting. Carrie, you also wanted to.
Yeah, I wanted to apologize. I owe Bruce an apology. The last time we were on, I had mentioned a couple of those in the draft report. I understood after our last meeting that there were going to be revisions to that report, and I unfortunately did not get a chance to look at the revised report to see if those errors were still in there. I definitely did catch one, and I don't know if it's worth bringing that up now before we vote on this. But I would, and Bruce, again, my apologies. I want to say it was towards the end. On page 11, the two paragraphs right before the conclusion appear to be redundant. And it looks like one was meant to stay and one was meant to go. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. They both start with though the traditional sources of funding. I don't know if you see that.
I'll have to refer back to that because I don't. By the way, I did post a link to the report so everybody can find that in chat. I don't have it open in front of me at the moment to look at the edit, but we can make that change.
I just thought I would mention it if we were going to vote on it. It might be worth, you know, making that correction to the final.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody else spotted it.
You're mentioning it and I'm remembering it. And I didn't flag it myself for okay. Bruce either. So
that was the one that jumped back out at me. And while we're waiting for a quorum, I'll see. I'm just going to go back and see if okay. The other.
Mr. Chairman, since I have the master copy here, I'm looking at it. If Carrie, if you could just tell me what it is.
Well, if you go back down to page, I believe it's 11.
Yep.
Okay. And if you look at the last two paragraphs right before conclusion.
Yeah, that second one shouldn't be there.
Okay. I just thought I'd.
Great.
One of them was supposed to be deleted, but I didn't know which one. So, and I apologize. I didn't tell Bruce that 2 days ago. I was kind of waiting for the revised report before I started making, because I figured some of the corrections might have been made. But I did catch that is still there. And,
great. Thank you. Thanks for that catch. All right. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to stack up a whole lot of voting items for hopefully if we can add a couple of the folks that will get us to a quorum. So in the meantime, let's move to item 8 on our agenda, which is the UConn and the UGA studies to start. I don't know, Lyle, do you have an update on those?
Yes. I've been in contact with Muhammad El-Qadri and Kylie Booley, who did the shared service paper. And we have a shared service paper that CROG did for the National Association of Regional Councils. So I'm going to be meeting with Professor El-Qadri to move ahead on that. And I talked to CCM on that as well. So we're going to organize that. I'm not sure about a timeline quite yet, but I will be moving ahead on that now that I've got all the players So Rick Porth was the contact from CCM, plus Muhammad El-Qadri, myself, and Kylie Woolley. So we're, the team is assembled. Now we just need to get the actual date and come back to you with a suggested date.
Great. Okay. Okay. And then we also wanted to talk about the ARPA question about infrastructure funding. Do we have anything more on that?
So that I believe you're going to have to wait until legislative session, because any of that proposal winds up going through the legislature as well. I have not heard any particulars on that. It's all been presented, you know, as I mentioned previously, to the secretary, and, you know, put in as a request for that funding. But that those proposals all do get voted on by the legislature for the use of the funds under the legislation they passed last year. So I don't have a further updated status on that.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you, Martin. And let's see. The only other non-voting item on our agenda is item number six, which Bruce weighs in on this to kind of remind us of our work plan. What we need to do on that?
You need to do nothing on it. I think last month I said I would have it to you in 3 weeks, and it's now 4 weeks later, and you still don't have it in your hands. I need to move some things into it from both the Home Rule report and the final form of the electronic meetings report to explain what was done last year, and also to say what is part of the work plan. So in the next week or so, you should see a draft of that, and I suppose it'll be at your March meeting when you can vote on it. And by the way, John L. Sesser joined, so you're now only one short of a quorum.
John, you're the man. Thank you. Are you dealing with ICE, John, yet?
Not yet.
Not yet, okay.
But I just am closing the town hall at noon because it's supposed to freeze over then. We're 1 degree above.
Yeah, right. Okay. Thank you for thanks for helping us out. I had another question for you, but given our time constraints, I'll pass about the air quality issue.
And Brendan,
yes.
Let me jump in to say Sam Gold is joining right now. See him. You have a quorum.
Sam, yeah. You're the man.
I told my CEOs I had to go. The meeting had to end anyway, so it was good.
God bless you, man. Thank you. Okay. I think it's true that it turned out that the weather is actually, even though we're doing this all remotely, it's still impacting our ability to meet. So so thank you all for jumping on. So while I've got you, and we've got everyone and we have a quorum, I'm going to go to the items on the agenda that we need to vote on and kind of try to do it rapidly. But, you know, obviously I don't want to cut off any conversation about it before we actually take the vote. The first, of course, is item two, which is the approval of the minutes from the January 7th meeting. Could I get a motion on that?
So moved.
Ron moved, and Jim, Sam seconded. Thank you. We'll acknowledge your presence, Sam. Are there any conversations about that? Okay, so if there are no conversations about the minutes, let me try your minds. All those in favor?
Aye.
Saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, thank you very much. Those minutes are adopted. And then the second item that we need a vote on is a topic that we had been discussing, folks who joined us more recently, which is the home rule document that John has put together along with comments from Steve Mednick. And just to kind of catch people up on this, what we've agreed to do is present to the legislature, and particularly to the Planning and Zoning Commission, a summary report on the legalities of home rule, constitutional, statutory, and otherwise, that are not really in question. And that's using a lot of Steve Mednick's presentation to us with some other edits, but with the understanding that the Planning and Development Committee, Senator Cassano included, intends to have a further conversation about home rule and its relationship to state-local relationships, something that the ACIR can dive into more deeply once that group gets, that legislative group gets pulled together. So, but for now, what we're going to be sending is that kind of summary of the legal aspects of this, which I know Chairman McCarthy-Vahey was particularly interested in getting started before the session started. So there was a revision to that that got posted on the chat. And if everyone is now who has been part of that conversation is comfortable with it, maybe I can get a motion on that.
I'll move.
So
second. Second move by John Filczek, second by Lyle.
Thank you. Okay. Are there any other comments on that or input? Senator Cassano, you're muted. I think you're still muted, Senator.
Can you hear me?
Now I can, yes.
Okay, all right. I keep shutting it off. Just as a follow-up, the home rule is a couple of things here that are major. I'd like to set up a meeting with perhaps you and Lyle and Senator Looney and Bob Duff just to get them on board. I think it would be helpful. We could do the same thing with the House. But I think that approach, that sit down, you know, we're kind of waking up from the dust. ACIR is becoming active and involved and productive. I think we need to get that message to the leadership, get their support so that we can know that we're going to get one or two things on that agenda, because it's not going to be a normal system. I think it's worth it if you want to do that.
Happy to do that, Senator. Yeah.
All right.
I don't want to speak for Lyle, but I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, that's great. And perhaps John as well, since
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, you know, John has done so much work on this. I think he'd be better than me.
Yeah.
You know, he's much, much better looking and writes better. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to have John as well, for sure.
Well, John is better looking than all of us, frankly.
There we go. That's what he says to me anyway. So, yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, Senator, for that suggestion. Any other comment on that report? If not, let me try your minds. All those in favor, signify with an aye. Any opposed or abstentions? Okay, great. Thank you for that. So that's on its way. And John will take up the question of how to transmit it to the committee. Probably, I think you're right, the way to transmit it is the way we did it via email on the interim report on the remote meetings. So speaking of remote meetings, item five on our agenda is the intrepid report on remote meetings that we were asked to produce by the legislature by way of Public Act 2102. We've been around with this and we've done a lot of work on this. I thank everyone who's participated on that in subcommittee roles and in advisory roles. I'd also like to thank CAMA and the FOIC and the Chief Information Officer, their office too, for the input that they've provided. I think it is really what they're looking for. And if we need to do some more and some follow-up, we'll take that direction as it comes. But let me first get a motion on that and then we can have any further comment. Motion for submitting that report?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by John, seconded by Lyle. Are there any comments on that report?
Mr. Chairman, I did make the corrections suggested by Carrie and I forwarded that to Bruce and yourself. So the corrected report is in your hands.
Okay, that's great. What was the correction? Is it anything substantive?
Removing the duplicate paragraph on page 11.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what Carrie was referring to. Right.
Yeah.
Got it. Understood. Yeah. Is there any other comments or input on the draft report on remote meetings? Heavy topic, lots of discussion. I think we should also expect that the Planning and Development Committee may and the GAE committee may ask for ACIR to come to a public hearing or two to discuss it as they deliberate on whether to extend the current authorization for remote meetings at the local level. So we may have a lot of other work to do on that. But with that proviso, and there's no other comment, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor of submitting to the remote meetings report to the legislature, signify with an aye.
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 Are there any opposed or abstentions? Okay, great. Thank you. I can breathe a sigh of relief. So that gives us a clean slate of all of the votable items that we need to actually produce. So thank you all. And thanks for folks who were otherwise occupied who were able to jump on to complete that vote. Okay, so with that, I will move to item 4 on our agenda now that we've jumped around, which is a presentation from CAPS involving the update to the blueprint on to transform Connecticut public schools. And with everyone's permission, I'd like to welcome Fran Rabinowitz, who is the executive director of CAPS, and Maureen as well, to welcome, actually, Fran back to ACIR for this update.
Yes.
And we look forward to hearing what you have to say. So, Fran, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brendan. And I want to thank ACIR for always allowing us to to bring forward the blueprint and our proposals as the legislative session convenes. We learned a lot last year in presenting the blueprint. We actually thought that it would be that the governor would just grab this blueprint and take it as his education policy and move it forward. And we also believe that the legislature would take the whole blueprint and use it as an education plan going forward, and we would chip away at it every year. But we found that not to be true, that in fact, it is a very expansive document. It goes over 15 years, and we have now responded to what was told to us, pick priorities. And so we're picking priorities for this legislative session. And I think they'll be in line with your priorities. We're saying fully fund the special ed excess cost grant. You haven't moved on that in well over 20 years. You have promised to fully fund, but it's funded at 75-78%.
Fran, could I interrupt you for just a sec? So when you're using the second person in your presentation, referring to you haven't funded it, you don't mean the ACIR members, right?
No. I mean us. I mean CAPS, guys. I hope it's ACIR, but it's CAPS. CAPS is recommending fully funding the excess cost grant and asking the state to move forward on that. And I don't think I'm telling you anything new. Special ed costs have gone, have skyrocketed across all of our school districts. As a matter of fact, in Hartford right now, it's 1/3 of the regular budget. And let me just say to you, you know, we at CAPS believe in the very best placement for every child, that they have to have a quality education. But we are, at the same time, we're pushing for excess costs to be fully funded. We are also saying to everyone that we do feel the numbers have exploded in special ed. We're now, you know, at an average of 18% in the school districts, where in 2011, we were at 11%. That's a huge increase. And so we have also asked for a task force to look at that. We're also working with our federal delegation, because when IDEA was put forward in the late 70s, they promised 40%. They're at about 6%. And so we've been working with our federal delegation to push it forward as well. We're also saying that all of us across the state have received more English learners in our classrooms, and that does require additional resources and additional dollars. And so we're asking for $7 million more, which is not a whole lot of money, to push that forward. We're also looking at the RESCs and saying, okay, if the special ed placements are there, can we fully fund the RESCs, give them $5 million to develop state-of-the-art special education programs, because they're more reasonable than putting students in private placements. Not only are they more reasonable, but they're held to standards. So we are asking for dollars to develop programs at the RESCs so that we can accommodate more special ed students. We're pushing on remote learning, and we're asking that it be able to be used in inclement weather, whatever that may be. We're asking for districts to be able to use virtual learning across districts. If I'm teaching Mandarin in my district and you're teaching Arabic in yours, can we share teachers across districts? And we're asking for that permission as well. And we're also looking at other pieces here in terms of teacher eval and training, but I'm trying to focus on the ones that really matter. I think, and not that they all don't matter, but that they're really crucial to the municipality as well. We continue to move forward with the ECS dollars. We're not in favor right now of Bill 948, which is pushing more money out to districts. However, it does still penalize 77 districts. You lose funding. 77 districts lose funding, some of which are ill able to lose it, like Colchester, Plainfield, et cetera. I don't know if that has momentum at the legislature, but we will be watching it carefully. It has some really good things in it, guys, about magnet school funding, et cetera. But it is expensive. It's about $380 million. It's also saying a one-time infusion of money into the magnets. Is that going to carry on perpetually? Are we going to know that magnets will be funded that way every year? Or is it just this year because the state happens to have more dollars? So that's where we are. We're taking it piece by piece, and hopefully, even if we just get the excess cost, I mean, I met with appropriations. They seem very interested in that. We'll see where it goes. So I'm open to questions. I don't know if how CCM feels about that. I don't even know how you may feel about the 948 bill, but I'd love to hear it. And I'll answer any questions on our agenda as well.
Thanks. Thank you, Fran. So one thing I just would remind you of, which you know, it may have kind of gone under the radar, but one of the accomplishments of this the 2021 legislative session for ACIR is the legislature did adopt our recommendation to fund RESCs and COGS with administrative funds. We're repurposing an existing grant that promoted regionalism, which was the RPIP money, if you remember. And what the legislature agreed to do was repurpose those funds to fund RESCs and councils of government to provide a service at the RESC that is otherwise being done individually by their individual members multiple times over. So on that one bullet point you offered about promoting RESCs taking on certain special ed services that are otherwise being done by individual districts, I would point you to the RPIP 2.0 and the availability of those funds to help cover the administrative costs of getting that up and running. And we could talk more offline about that.
Right. Thank you, Brendan. And that certainly is a a huge start. I just think that, you know, the RESCs have so much potential to offer so much more in terms of special ed and pre-special ed. Do you know what I mean? If we can intervene in time with students in some temporary programs to bring them into the right track, I think we'd be in good shape. I mean, these special ed, private special ed facilities are going anywhere up from 150 all the way over 200,000 per child. It's really crazy, and they are not held to academic standards as others are.
Right. Thank you. Yep. Lon?
Yeah, and just hi, Bren.
Hello, Lon.
Just to branch off on that, you know, the other problem you have with these private providers is that they can raise their prices anytime they want. So you're locked into these IEPs, and all of a sudden, you know, next year it's 50% more, and there's nothing you can do about it. So you know, the more that we can bring back locally into the state, I will say, just my experience for all of you on the call, you know, this year my budget, 2/3 of my budget increase is what we call recovery, but it's really special education. Because we have probably decades of catch up now, where we have students in grades that have had very different educational experiences, because some kids missed an entire year of in-person instruction. Some missed half the year. So we had children coming back to school in the spring who developmentally were where their peers were at the beginning of the year. So this compounds as we roll through. So the more that we can start, you know, keeping, you know, home in our district, it's best for the kid more often than anything else, because the least restrictive environment is the best one. You know, one thing I would suggest is in addition to the rest, that inter-district cooperation is something to consider on that as well. You know, we're doing that locally within our school district, where we're trying to find ways to combine services and try to, you know, reduce some of the cost related to some of these catch-up items. So that I think would be helpful too.
Yes, I agree. I'm taking all of these notes down, because, you know, they're always an enhancement, and I greatly appreciate getting your perspective on it as well.
Thanks, Lon. Yeah. Lon, you know, I know we talked about this internally within ACIR, but the, you know, that question that you've been raising about the, you know, the complications associated with getting districts to be able to cooperate with each other in a, you know, semi-intelligent way, given our statutes, without having to do the Rube Goldberg approach that you've managed. You know, is that another item also for our LGF subcommittee, do you think?
Yeah, you know, and this comes back to the study that we're still waiting on from the Department of Education, because back in, I think in the 2019 session, prior to the pandemic, you know, the department was asked to look into this topic of
you know, creating new school districts from the, you know, from agreements. It was part of our recommendation plan as well. And we haven't seen that report yet as to how that might appear. And I know a lot of legislators, every time I bring this up, is there a study? I said, well, there should be one. So I know there's a lot of interest. And I can tell you I'm getting calls from districts in smaller towns trying to figure out how they might work together. And, you know, the more clarity that the department can provide, I think the better, because to some degree, you know, there's no restriction for a lot of this kind of inner collaboration. And in some ways, our interpretation of the law actually restricts the desire to have more cross collaborations between districts. I don't think there's actually a statutory restriction to prevent cooperation, but it would be great to get some clarity about where we could go with it. And that report would be really helpful. It was in Public Act 19-91, Section 6. And that report was due on January 1st of 2020.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
I guess that's a law, right? Like, it has to be done, right? Because it's a law.
Well, as far, you know, last I checked, when the legislature told the ACIR to produce a report by February 1st, we produced a report by February 1st. So I don't know, I don't know why the SDE can decide that they are not going to comply. So,
yeah, I did ask back in July, and there was no update. So I can ask again and see where it's at. But it would be good, because I think it would be helpful to just even to think out how things could look. And it's not like this is going to make sense for every school district. And right now, of course, if two school districts want to collaborate on a program, they can. But when you get into the question of opening schools together or combining special education services, this is where the LEA interface, because LEAs are how the federal government interacts with the state. LEAs are defined by the state. And right now, if you're not in a regional school district or in a single town district, that connection point gets really muddled. So yes, if we can start looking at the definitions better, it's not like we're going to just break down district barriers, but it does help, I think, solve a lot of these special ed problems, because we're siloed. And sometimes when we try to do things outside the silo, the State Department says, no, you can't do that because of the federal law. But it's really about how we have created the interface to federal law that creates the issue. So the study would help, I think, open up some thoughts here about how do we look at this definition a little less rigidly? And, you know, as we're looking at issues related to equity in education, this, you know, how we interpret this federal law is actually limiting equity. So I think there's ways that districts don't want, look, I'm having meetings locally about how do we fund our elementary education, because we have so much excess capacity right now. Taxpayers are looking for solutions without closing schools, and, you know, we're limited because we're locked in. So that's, I'm a broken record on it, but I think it's important.
Well, I just ask, and I ask you to think about how we could be helpful on that particular topic as well. And well, we can talk more about that. And Maureen, I know you had your hand up.
I was just going to echo what Lon already said very eloquently, that we have done small sharing of services between districts. I've done that with Berlin. I know other districts have done it, but the wider scale, if there's legislative roadblocks, then I agree that that needs to be pursued. So thank you.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, it would really help regionalism, and it would really help moving some of the opportunities for kids, Lon, especially in the equity area. I would have loved to have sent some kids when I was in Bridgeport to remote learning on advanced physics. I didn't have that teacher. And I think it could really create some real good momentum, but we need some help on that.
And there is a remote learning commission that I'm on for CABE that's looking at, and they just are working on their draft now, the recommendations for how that would work. And
yeah,
you know, I think there's a lot. I was just on a CABE. We had a CABE breakfast in my local region the other day, and Representative Carney from Old Saybrook brought up a good idea about, you know, meeting some of these mandates on electives, and having some of those electives conducted remotely would also be helpful. And this comes back actually, Brendan, to some of your work on scheduling, because, and this goes way back to when I was in high school, we opened up distance, they call it distance learning back in my day. We opened up these distance learning centers in all the local schools, but it never happened because everyone was on a different schedule.
Right.
So there's still some physical limitations here. But no, you're right. I mean, I think those are things that we could start doing. And the more opportunities we have to talk to each other and come up with ideas, I think the more that these things kind of come out. And I won't take up too much more time, but I do think that one of the advantages of Connecticut having all these different municipalities and all these different school districts is that there's a lot of opportunities for trying out ideas and see what kind of bubbles up as something that's successful. And to a degree, that's an advantage over a state with a couple of counties that can't innovate like that. So, you know, let's start looking at things a little less rigidly here. And I think that'll help advance the policy goals.
Agreed. Right. Agreed.
John, you had a question, and then Jim.
I just wanted to second what Lon's been stating. I see it in real time out here. We have two small towns that would like to do something with an elementary school in a cooperative manner, but there's hesitation due to the lack of clarity with the statutes. And I think this fits right into the study that we're talking about with planning and development, because we've got to get beyond the hesitancy that these school districts have and towns have for whatever the cooperative or shared arrangement might be. But there's quite a bit of it. And despite the statutes, which seem to imply we can do all these things, there is hesitation. And that's, I think, a critical question we need to answer as to why that is and what we can do to change that.
Thanks. Yep. And Jim?
Just quickly, I agree with Lon. We really should take a look at this. It's just a detail. It's sort of a detail that really cripples some progress in our district. So,
right. I think maybe it might be the thing, and we'll kind of leave that one topic. But before we do, I just wanted to say that maybe it's also just about ACIR just sending a letter to the Department of Education saying, "Where's the study?" And maybe goosing them a bit on this to get it moving. But I, having said that, that may be an immediate role that we can help be helpful with. But are there any other thoughts about the CAPS proposal and what Fran's presentation is on their own priorities for this year? I know she kind of put Ron a little bit on the spot as to, you know, how CCM is reacting or may react to that, their proposal.
I'm
putting you on the spot.
Thanks. No, number one, I love the focus on special ed and trying to work on the state and, of course, the federal level. It would be great if we could have a partnership with working with the federal delegation, because we've been trying to lobby for more an additional investment on behalf of the federal government. It's another topic that we're going to be discussing at our meeting on Thursday, and I'll be able to give more information then.
Great. Okay.
That would be great. I'd love that partnership. I think it would be even more powerful, and I think this is a good time to really push on it. So
I agree.
Thank you.
And by the way, you're looking at declining enrollments. You're looking at the stress and strain of COVID recovery, and you're looking at enormous costs and a lot of overlapping administrative costs to provide these services right now. That's going to be the story. And on top of that, this puts pressure back down on general education. So when you're talking about comprehensive high schools, what do you lose when you're under financial strain is all the stuff that makes you comprehensive, because you don't have to have it. You know, that's the real pressure. And I think one of the big selling points of Connecticut as a place to move to, especially with all the people we picked up during the pandemic, is the strength of the schools. So, you know, general education here is at risk, and we've really got to look at ways that we can make it better And we have a lot of excess capacity that we could be combining in smart ways that would be acceptable to local taxpayers because they could be in control. So that's I'll leave it there.
Great. I agree, Lon.
Thank you. So thank you, Fran. Are there certain things that we can do that you'd recommend that maybe ACIR can be helpful?
Well, I think I would, Brendan, I think I would be in touch with you. You know, if you can do, if we just concentrate on the special ed piece, it would be phenomenal. And if we could concentrate on getting them to think about fully funding the excess costs at the state level while we're working at the federal level, I think that would be incredibly helpful. I also hope that they will, you know, they said in the 2021 session, they would have a task force on special ed, and they didn't, but they intend to carry it over now. And I do think we need a task force on it. We need to look at it. We need to look at why the numbers are increasing and if there are alternatives to that. You know, with that said, with the caveat, we want the best for every child, but are there ways that we can intervene with children that are not specifically special ed?
Right. Okay.
Like teaching them to read well, you know, early on. That's, right. I have a passion on that. And I feel that if they can't read, they can't move forward. And I think we could do more in that area.
Yeah. Great. Thanks. Sheila.
That would be amazing. And I think we're on the same wavelength also with the just the sharing among districts and being able to cut out whatever the bureaucracy is there that doesn't allow this to happen. You know, to James's point about sharing an elementary school, I mean, that's a great idea, or sharing a special ed program, or sharing courses. I think it just makes such common sense to me. And it's very frustrating that there are so many bureaucratic barriers to it.
Right. Right. Thanks. Sheila.
Thank you for the opportunity. I just wanted to share that CABE is very much pursuing the special ed excess cost reimbursement grant removing of that cap on that grant. So that is something that we're working with CAPS, and but mostly at the moment we're working with the school special ed administrators to gather some data so that we can best lobby. So we'll get you that figures too if you all want to take a look at it. But essentially, and I'll give you the small breakdown. If it costs the district $10,000 to educate a student, at 4.5 times that cost that districts must then spend, above that, the state should be fully funding that reimbursement grant. And it's as Fran so eloquently said, they're not. It's about 74%. So if you've got an outplacement of, you know, over $100,000, the state's reimbursement grant of around 43 or so is just not happening. Not to the full extent, I should say. And that's where it's more than tens of thousands of dollars. It's twenties of thousands of dollars per student. And again, it depends on how many students the district seeks reimbursement for. But in the urban municipalities, there's an awful lot of students that are ID'd. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Lon?
Sorry to keep talking. I just had another idea as we were discussing this. I wonder if there might be an incentive opportunity here in relation to the excess cost grant to, you know, provide more reimbursement to towns that do work together on cooperative special education programs.
And I would think that could be a real possibility. And the other thing that could be a possibility is changing the formula for district programs and rest programs, which are less expensive. So maybe reimbursing them at 3.5 times the per pupil cost rather than 4.5 times. Do you know what I'm saying? If you're holding more kids in the district or between districts or at a rest, which is a lower cost overall, that the state reimburse at a higher rate.
Right, because to some degree you're penalized for making your special ed more efficient because your cost.
Absolutely.
So you end up encouraging what you're trying to prevent. And,
absolutely.
You know, and what's amazing is that, and I found this a lot of times when we look at things locally on our Board of Ed, oftentimes what's best for taxpayers ends up being best for kids at the same time, because keeping those kids in that school, and it's amazing the kind of things we've seen with those kids being with their peers. So
yes, there's nothing like it. It's the least restrictive environment, and keeping them in as close to their neighborhood school as we can works wonders. Guys, I've got to run to another meeting, but appreciated the time. I know you do.
No, appreciate that. Yeah, appreciate you coming and telling us about this. So thank you.
And I will be, I'm back at any time you need me, and anything we can do together. We know we exist within a municipality, and what affects us affects you and vice versa. So thank you.
Agreed. Thanks, friend. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Maureen. Okay, great. So with that, is there any other business that we should be taking on? I'm mindful of the clock and our efforts to try to finish up by noon. So are there any other items? Seeing none, or any other comments from the public? If there are none, then our LGF subcommittee meeting is February 22nd. So, Jim, maybe you and Bruce and I can collaborate a little bit on putting that meeting together for the subcommittee, okay, on the emergency management systems. And then our next full meeting of the ACIR will be Friday, March 4th, same time, same bat channel. And if there's nothing else, thank you all. Thanks for jumping away from other busy things that are going on right now. And I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Lyle, seconded by Lon. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Great. Thank you all. Stay safe today and tomorrow, and have a great weekend, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Everybody.
Right. Can you and Lyle stay on leave the link on for a minute?
I have just a minute because I've got to jump to another meeting myself.
Okay, how do you propose that we get together to have that discussion?
I don't know. I'm wondering if maybe...